Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Our topic for tonight is San Francisco's live music scene. With the Bay Area Music Festival season coming to an end, it would seem to the music consumer that the San Francisco live music scene is thriving. But to those trying to make it in the trenches, the story is not so clear. From classical to rock, the chances to play live music are changing. Where does a band get its start in the Bay Area? Are there enough opportunities for musicians to make a living in the city, a city as expensive as San Francisco? And why is San Francisco not on the map as a great music city in the country? Joining me to answer these questions and more are, in studio, Jerry Melander, who's the founding member of the local band Swedish, and he's here with his lead guitarist, Greg Becerra. Welcome, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And David Schoenbrunn, who's the president of the Local 6 Music Union, who represents over 1,700 professional musicians in five counties in the Bay Area. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Lauren.
And Mike Sempert, the founder of the touring band, San Francisco band, Birds and Batteries. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And then also, we also have, at the top of the show, we're going to talk briefly with independent musician and Grateful Dead guru, Bay Area music journalist David Gans. We're hoping, actually, he's going to join us a little bit into the show. So, and of course, we'll be taking calls from you. We'll start taking calls about 7:20, 7:30. So give us a call at 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So let me start out with you, Jerry. You're the founding member of Swedish. What would you say the live music scene is like today?
Well, I'd say competition is definitely there. And now when I say competition, it's certainly in its art. It's not a competitive landscape, but there's a lot of bands doing the same type of thing as trying to get out there. And there's some that are in there just for, you know, kind of personal enjoyment, just to play in front of their friends, and there's some out there really trying to, you know, get to the next level or get some exposure.
And how would you describe your band?
So we're, you know, there's traditionally three types of bands in terms of, you know, how successful you are. I'd say there's local, there's regional, and there's national. So we're definitely in the local scene. We've been playing together for, you know, 15 years in college, and we've been in this band, Swedish, for about 7 years or so, and, you know, released a couple albums. So still at that area of, you know, not doing what we enjoy doing and, you know, having our friends come out and, you know, just enough to not, you know, consider it a full-time profession to make, yeah.
Okay, but is this what you do for a living?
Certainly not.
Okay.
I am the guy who's got a full-time job and three kids at home.
Oh, my gosh. Good for you. Yeah. And a wife who's like, could you take your band?
Yeah. What would it take for you to stop playing right now?
So would you, and why did you choose San Francisco? I mean,
I'm raised in the South Bay. And so we went to school up at Chico State. And this is just where you know, our roots are.
Uh-huh.
So.
Okay. And so what about you, Mike? You know, you also are in a San Francisco band, but it's slightly different in terms of where it's at, right?
Yeah, a little bit. I live in Oakland, so and is this program exclusively about San Francisco?
No, it really is Bay Area.
Bay? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Good. And yeah, I mean, I don't feel like I'm in that different a position, actually. I mean, my band's been doing this for, Birds and Batteries has been in existence for about 6 years, and we've been touring, you know, as much as we can for a good chunk of that time. And we have, you know, we have toured nationally. I don't know if that makes us a national band, you know, like, I think we're still a small band and dealing with a lot of the same questions that these guys are. And I think, you know, most people in bands are dealing with.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go back to you guys, but actually let me loop in David Gans, who I think has joined us. Welcome, David.
Hello.
Hi. So, David, you were there, and you know, we have these guys that have, you know, are in the band scene today. You were there in the '70s. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your history, kind of what you were doing, how you got involved, and a little bit about the scene in the 70s in San Francisco, when I think that's when people really think of San Francisco's thriving music scene. It was back then.
Well, I'm still there, actually. I'm still a working musician, although I have other jobs as well. My first paying gig was in 1970 in San Jose, and I've been playing professionally or semi-professionally ever since. And that was kind of, you know, after the psychedelic 60s, which sent so many amazing bands up into the big leagues, you know, and it was before the DIY revolution that gave us punk rock and the Fab Mab and all that stuff. But I was part of a sort of a singer-songwriter scene in the early days, you know, and there were always venues to go play, but there were not a lot of places to make a lot of money. In those days, you know, you could get a record deal and become Jackson Browne or something like that, and a few people, I guess, came up out of the Bay Area to do that kind of thing. But, you know, it's always been a struggle to make a living doing the music that you want to do.
Now, have you found that the city seems like it's the same in terms of the kinds of questions these guys were talking about, or do you think that the scene's changed? Do you think it was a little bit easier to start off in San Francisco?
I missed the beginning of this conversation, so I don't know exactly what my fellow participants were talking about, but I think that one of the things about the current scene is that everything is so fragmented on every level in every medium that it's impossible for anybody to really know what's going on everywhere. A young friend of mine from Colorado who plays in a band called the Yawpers, and I went to see them last week in a venue. I can't even remember the name of the venue now. I'm sorry. A bar on Polk Street. And I was surprised to see, you know, three bands playing like 50-minute sets in a row. And I was surprised to see a room full of people, you know, enjoying what they were doing. And so it just led me to believe, you know, there are musical scenes going on all over the place that I'm not even dimly aware of. You know, I play the Ashkenaz at Berkeley regularly. I play the Rancho Nicasio from time to time with a Beatles jam band called Rubber Soldiers. I play at the Southern Pacific Smokehouse in Novato from time to time. I have played Connecticut Yankee. You know, there are venues all around the Bay Area, and many of them only cater to certain kinds of music. You know, the kind of stuff that I do that I guess is kind of hippie folk rock on a certain level is welcome in some venues and is of no interest at all to other venues. You know, I don't think I'm likely to play bottom of the hill with what I do. I played the Connecticut Yankee a few times.
Okay, well, take us back to the early 70s, and what was the scene like? And, I mean, as you said, you know, it came right off of the psychedelic 60s. What, you know, how would you get started if you were back in the 70s? How did bands get started? You talked to a lot. One of the things you didn't really talk about is that you were a journalist. You're a music journalist who interviewed a lot of amazing bands, including The Dead, who you've written books about, Talking Heads, Fleetwood Mac, Doobies.
Yeah. Well, I wandered into journalism because it was a fun way to add, you know, additional dollars to my income. I was, you know, you'd make $50 playing a gig, and you could make $50 or $60 or $75 writing a story, you know, for a BAM magazine and stuff. So I started getting into music journalism because I could write and because it was a way to expand my connections and horizons and stuff. I met a million people, and I got what I consider like a fabulous education by being able to go hang out in studios and talk to producers and stuff. So journalism became both an additional source of income and a way to get out there into the world and meet more people and stuff. It winds up being kind of a handicap in a way, because now I'm very well known as a radio personality here in the Bay Area because I have a show on KPFA and stuff. I think of myself as a musician with a radio show, but I sometimes feel like I'm being regarded as a disc jockey with a guitar. You know what I mean? But in the early 70s, there were places like the Boarding House, and what this industry could use right now is another guy like David Allen, who ran the Boarding House. He was an amazing character, and he did this great thing. He would find something that he thought was good, and he'd book it into the Boarding House, which originally was at 960 Bush Street, now demolished and turned into condos, then later moved over to 901 Columbus. I'm not even sure what's there now. But David would book an act in for 2 weeks, and he would just throw the doors open and wait for the world to discover it. And he did this with the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, which was this really strange and wonderful sort of psychedelic vaudeville show, and that became Oingo Boingo, which then spawned the career of Danny Elfman, who's now like this huge movie music guy.
So how would the, I don't understand how would this boarding house work?
He brought Emmylou Harris was another one. He would just bring acts in and he'd put them on. I think Steve Martin was another one of his discoveries, and he would just book this thing for, he thought it was good, and he would book the act for 2 weeks, and even if nobody'd ever heard of them, he would invest his time and his club in making that act available to the Bay Area and then getting people to come and hear it. And he would rely on word of mouth, possibly a mention in Herb Cain's column or whatever and stuff. You know, nowadays, one huge difference I can tell you is that nobody will take any chances anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
One of the musical things that I do is a band called Rubber Soldiers. It's with Chris and Lauren Rowan. We sing, we play. Our little elevator pitch is, if the Beatles had played their last concert at Candlestick Park and stayed in San Francisco and started playing the Fillmore, this is what they'd sound like. We stretch them out and make, you know,
uh-huh.
like the Beatles, 3 minutes, you know. They do these amazing grooves and then quit them after 3 minutes. So we figure we'll stretch them out, you know,
okay.
and run the songs together and stuff. We played at Slim's in January, and we drew 77 paid. And there were about 100 people there. We had a really, really great show. People loved it, screamed and yelled and demanded an encore. And on Monday morning, when our agent called to talk to the people there about how we did, they said, well, you got to pull 350 people or we can't book you. Sorry,
okay.
You're done.
Well, let me ask, you brought up some really interesting things. Let me loop back to Mike. I mean, do you feel like people in San Francisco are promoting bands like they did at the boarding house?
Well, I couldn't say. I wasn't there at the boarding house.
Sure. Well, I mean, from what you hear.
I mean, you know, that I think it's fair to say that that was a different time. I do think that there are people here that they might not get on board with the band in quite that same way, with like a 2 week residence. That doesn't seem to really happen anymore. That sounds awesome, though. But I do think that there are bookers and venues that, you know, if they like you, they'll help you out. And there's also some cool kind of situations where clubs have relationships with other clubs or are actually owned by the same folks, like Hotel Utah and Cafe du Nord. So, you know, if you start out playing Hotel Utah, and it might take you a while to get in there, but you're in there and you do a good job and you promote your show, people come out, then, you know, you've got a shot at playing at Cafe du Nord, you know, next time. And there's a similar relationship with Slim's and Great American, also, you know, owned by the same company. So I do feel like there are opportunities here, but again, I can't compare because
you guys want to say something or?
I just think the platform for artist development has changed.
Okay,
so basically, that artist development back in the 70s, like he's saying, they would actually shut down a place for 2 weeks and let one band develop themselves in the area that they were playing. Whereas now, artist development is much different. It's about getting people in and out. And there's not much, you're not given as much time to make yourself be exposed to the people you want to be exposed to, your fans, okay. increasing your fan base.
That's Greg Becerra talking. Do you guys feel that the exposure they expect with the whole everything being online, that they expect you to get your fan base and develop the exposure through Facebook or through
yes.
your website?
All
I hear David are. Saying yes.
Well, I think that's very big. You know, some
Jeremy.
Of these venues, a lot what Mike was saying is that, you know, they'll stop and take a look at who you are and what your brand is. So mm-hmm. it's not about you just saying, hey, I like to play music. Will you let me play?
Right.
Okay, you're going to play on Monday night. Well, we want to play a Thursday night. Okay, let's take a look at your social networking, how many fans you have. I mean, they really dig that deep.
Yeah, they do.
Wow.
I don't think that's that deep to dig, though. I mean, you just go to the Facebook page and you see how many friends are there, and I mean, I think usually it's a representation of just how long you've been doing it. Although there are bands that maybe get like a ton of likes all at once. I mean, I think it can be frustrating to feel like they're going based on numbers, and that's kind of a drag. But
are venues not interested in developing young artists? Do you think
they can't afford to?
You're saying they can't afford to. That's
general. I mean, it would be great if they could, and there are some here and there. You find people who really love music. I also think, for example, Tom Miller, who runs Don Quixote's down in Felton, And I think he books a couple of other venues also. Just a great guy, and he's got great taste in music, and I always enjoy talking with him and stuff. But he's it seems like they have to book these tribute bands, you know. Petty Theft and Super Diamond, there's all these bands that are tributes to older music acts, and they draw much better than original music does, which puts everybody in a bind, except, of course, the tribute bands.
And the tribute really meaning cover.
I think that's a good thing to think about. Yes, and I have to say that Rubber Soldiers, we don't do that. We stretch it out. We make it our own. You know, I have to put that disclaimer.
Well, let me bring in David Schoenbrunn. David, you are the president of the Local 6 Musicians Union, who represents over 1,700 professional musicians. What kind of musicians want your representation?
Well, I think our members run the gamut in the musical world, from orchestral musicians, certainly, recording musicians, and theater musicians. And it used to be that our membership was from a much broader spectrum that included a lot of club playing and restaurant playing musicians, hotel musicians, and so forth. Things changed.
It used to be. What does that mean?
Well, things changed. There was a legal ruling in the late 70s that essentially, I don't want to bore you with the details, but it sort of destroyed that part of the business for the union and destroyed it for the musicians in the sense that they could not really be represented any longer by the union. And a court held that the employer of musicians was the band leader as opposed to the venue, and it made it impossible for the union to negotiate with venues about wages and benefits.
Right.
So things changed in a hurry. And now things have deteriorated to the point where, as you know, we're hearing here, you know, bands, and it's incredible to me because I come from the other side of the musical universe where we're not responsible for promoting our own thing at all. That's somebody else's job. And we're just responsible for getting there on time and playing.
You're talking about the classical orchestra.
Or in the theater, you know, at the Kern or the Golden Gate Theaters, going in.
So I'm curious, when was there a time in San Francisco when everyone had to be represented or wanted representation? Or was there... Or has it always been kind of the non-rock pop people that...
Yeah. Well, the American Federation of Musicians made a gigantic mistake in the 60s. They thought that rock was sort of a passing thing. gigantic. Did I say gigantic? I meant tremendous. And the official word from up high in New York was that, you know, don't have to worry about these people. It'll be gone in a while, and we'll go back to being our comfortable jazz and classical playing selves. And, of course, we find that that wasn't the case at all. So they sort of really missed the boat and said goodbye to a huge portion of the music industry at the same time. Now, since then, there are a lot of bands that have come back into the fold and are union members because they can take advantage of certain benefits, especially around recording, that having union contracts affords them. But
then, like you guys, I mean, Mike, would you ever think about joining the union, or do you? Are you?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
We were just talking about that,
and it's funny because I was speaking with a friend of mine who is a really versatile violinist who plays in a lot of local bands and has played in a lot of touring bands, but really focuses on his passion, you know, project. And but he's a union musician. He was telling me about it, and I was looking into it, and then it turns out I'm on a panel with this gentleman, so it's kind of neat.
Timing, good
timing. Yeah, totally.
I want to thank David Gansey, who could only join us for a little bit. So, David, thank you for joining us this evening. You're a musician in your own right, as well as journalist, music journalist. Thank you so much for giving us kind of a taste of the 70s as we move back to the 2011, almost 2012. And if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the Bay Area's live music scene, and joining me are Jerry Melander, who's the founding member of the local band Swedish, and David Schoenbrunn, who's the president of the Local 6 Music Union, who represents the 1,700 music professional musicians in the Bay Area, and Mike Sampert, who's the founder of the touring band Birds and Batteries. If you'd like to join us, here's the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I'm curious. I want to hear from anyone who goes and listens to live music. What you think? Do you feel like there's a lot, you know, do you feel like you never know where to go? Do you feel like, and if you're a musician out there, how hard is it for you? We want to hear from you too. Again, the number is 415-841-4134, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, yeah, I want to go back to Mike from Birds and Batteries.
Oh, well, I just had a quick concern. I mean, it crossed my mind when I was initially invited to do this, that this was going to be sort of the type of thing where it was like we were kind of complaining about the music industry or something. Uh-huh. And I think, I don't know, I'm hoping that we can maybe turn the tide on that a little bit, because I don't want that to be what this is all about. Or yeah. Maybe that's...
Sort of the angle? I think that the angle is what I'm talking to you guys and trying to figure it out. So
right.
To your point, I think that when talking to some people from the past, as well as to people that are in it, you know, they're looking at the industry from a purely dollars and cents standpoint.
Right.
I think there's concern that the scene has really kind of died to a degree.
Yeah, I think the scene is alive and well in San Francisco.
Excellent.
And I don't think that's really the problem. I think that the problem is that we're dealing with way, way bigger issues in terms of digital technology and you know, creativity in general in the 21st century. I mean, when you look at sort of the cultural stuff that came out of the first 10 years of the century, it's not that impressive, and it's mostly, some of it's great, but it's pretty reflective of the 20th century and the music and books and films that came out of that. And I just feel like, oh wow, the phones are ringing. I feel like I feel like there's greater things at work. And I do think the scene here is fantastic. I think it's rivaled. Obviously, New York and Brooklyn, you know, have a better reputation. And I think that there's a lot to be said for the scenes there. Portland has a great reputation. But other than that, it's hard to think of a better place. And I'm saying the Bay Area. San Francisco is really expensive.
Sure. Okay. And David, you want to add on to that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would also say that I think the challenge is doesn't just lie with musicians in the music industry, but also lies with the public. And I think there is now a need for an attitude change, that people feel that they deserve to, well, it's probably a function of technology, deserve to listen to great music for free, and deserve to be able to download things for free, and deserve to be able to watch movies for free. And it's a difficulty in that people come and listen to musicians and they feel comfortable that they're being entertained and maybe don't have to pay all that much for that entertainment. But at the same time, the guys like Jerry who want to, you know, who have three kids at home, they don't want to necessarily have another job on the side and play music as a hobby or as a sideline. They want to be full-time musicians. And I think that's ultimately where it suffers, because Jerry can't develop his musical life the way he ought to be able to. And it's because we have a culture right now which is not really embracing the fact that musicians ought to be compensated for what they do. It's a lot of people who
was that, do you know, I mean, you've been, it sounds like you've been around for a while. I mean, was there ever a time when that happened?
Yeah, I think more so than now.
Okay. So let me ask you guys, so let's go back to this. I mean, you know, there's the music scene, and there's what we as listeners listen to, and then there's the players. And that's, I think, what the show is mostly is like, looking in the trenches, you know, because I think that from, you know, if you look as someone that's consuming the music, I mean, there definitely is the free aspect, but there's also, there are a lot of free or relatively free festivals, concerts out there. Used to be maybe more or less, Bill Graham was a big, yeah, but it seems like, you know, things are picking up. But do you find that's opening the doors for you guys to become musicians more on a professional level, or do you feel like it's actually just making it harder?
By all means, I think it's opening the door wide open. So it's interesting because, you know, the title of this is The Live Music in San Francisco, but if you want to talk about, it all comes down to this. We're all going after the same thing, which is exposure. I mean, the greater hand you get with exposure, the more people are going to know who you are, come to your shows, buy your albums, whether it be 99 cents, download it for free. It all kind of boils down to that. And the better alignment you can get with that, the better you can market yourself, you know, the more you're successful in doing what you want to do.
Excellent. Well, let me, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer, and tonight we're discussing the Bay Area's music scene, we'll say, live and not live. My guests are Jerry Melander, the founding member of the local band Swedish, with his lead guitarist Greg Becerra, David Schoenbrunn, who's the president of the Local 6 Musicians Union, Mike Sempert, who's the founding member of the touring San Francisco band Birds and Batteries. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. We really would love to hear from you about your take on the music scene, what you like, what you don't like. We don't want this to be just a negative conversation. Not all of us. But let me go to a first caller for this evening. We have Amy from San Francisco. Good evening, Amy.
Good evening.
Thanks for calling in.
I'm good. I had two questions and comments, really. Just I'm a professional musician, and I just moved back to San Francisco after living in Los Angeles for the last 9 years. And I had a question for, I believe it was Jerry, who was commenting about the music scene in San Francisco being alive and well, which, I mean, I think it will always survive.
But that was me, actually.
That's Mike.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mike. Yeah, I had just tuned in, so I apologize. My question, though, really was how many musicians you know who are able to make a living by being 100% a performing musician in San Francisco?
How many musicians I know? Well, I can think of, you know, three or four, but that's people who I'm friends with. I mean, I'm sure there's more. I understand what you're getting at. It's definitely, it's not a lot. It's not as many as there should be.
Thank you. I mean, I think the music always survive, but
right.
I think after, I guess, 10 years, I'm noticing most of my friends and fellow people that I play with have so many, there's been this mass exodus to the East Bay.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yeah, I feel like I'm one of those.
I used to live in San Francisco, now live further and further out.
Oh, okay, well, I should change my answer then, because none of the people that I'm thinking of actually live in San Francisco.
Okay.
Well, actually, no, one of them does. Okay.
We have to do the Bay. And then my second question was for the gentleman who, I'm forgetting his name, who's the head of the union in San Francisco.
David,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a member of the union in L.A., and I just wondered how many opportunities there are for musicians, and you could probably elaborate on this. You know, like that I saw, I mean, I was a member because you could do a bunch of, you know, there were sidelining gigs as well as tours or different kinds of, I don't know, off gigs associated with, like, the movie and television industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered, with this kind of burgeoning Hollywood that's coming up north, if that kind of ever extends to the musicians in the Bay
Area.
Those
are great questions, Amy.
Well, we haven't seen, there is certainly sidelining work available, not as much as in Los Angeles or New York, for that matter. We see it from time to time. As far as film scoring, there's quite a bit of that that goes on. Well, there used to be more than there is right now. Right now, up at Skywalker Ranch, which is the only studio that's really equipped to do film scoring, they're doing a lot more video games than anything else there right now, and which is a burgeoning industry in and of itself. I don't know what instrument you play, but it certainly lends itself to orchestral instruments more than guitars, unfortunately, for these guys.
Amy, those are really great questions. Let me ask some of these guys. I mean, do you all think about doing things other than playing gigs, you know, like what Amy's talked about, Mike?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Have you, and Jeremy?
I don't know if you had anything else to add, but I scored music for a few software companies around here, so post-production. They send in the video files, and we score music to it. And let me tell you, it takes 60, 80 hours. It's a whole other ball game. So, yeah, that's the only other work I've done.
Okay. Well, let me take another caller. We have Stephen from Berkeley on the phone. Good evening, Stephen.
Good afternoon, Lauren. Good evening. I mean, who knows?
So you're a street musician. You're a street musician.
Like
excellent.
Any musician, we're kind of out of whack, I suppose. But I'm a street musician, and I don't write my songs, but I can make up words to various tunes. And it is bleak out there in the street, making money these days. I play in East Bay.
And but, then tell us a little bit about what you do. I mean, when you say street musician, do you, play the guitar?
I play a 12-string and harmonica, and I have a foot thumper. I have jerry-rigged with a tambourine and a foot pedal.
Okay, and did you, and so do you play, you know, in the middle of Berkeley? And
oh, yeah, I play on Telegraph Avenue. I've been up there for about 7 years or so.
7 years. And has it gotten worse? Has the economy gotten worse?
The economy is terrible.
Okay.
You know, it is just ruining this street performance stuff. The fire on Telegraph hasn't helped either, either for the places up there or the businesses. And everybody just seems to be in a totally big funk. And like, I'm kind of jaded in this music scene around here because, I saw a lot of shows in, the late 60s and, you know, this music scene is something that I find hard to relate to because, it's like every band is now the garage band on the stage and, the selections don't seem to be that good.
Is it the music or the music scene?
I hate to be critical. Excuse me?
Is it the music or the music scene? Jeremy wants to know.
Scene, there's all these venues everywhere, but all the music now. It was a time when San Francisco created its own sound. You know, the San Francisco sound.
I think very much it still has its own sound for sure. It's just okay. it's a different taste. And yeah. Music, you know, taste is indisputable. It's different from everybody, so.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to show people next, Jeremy, and I'm going to have Jeremy and Greg play a little bit of their stuff. But before we do that, let me just ask, I want to ask about music education in the city because, you know, it's interesting to hear when people are, you know, the flip side is getting people to appreciate music. And do you feel that there's enough music education that, you know, this coming groups of kids and student, you know, students are even getting enough to appreciate what music is other than just, I guess, what the pop culture gives them, like Britney Spears and whatnot. I don't, David?
Well, I think there's a dearth of music education, certainly. We see that when schools think about, have limited funding, the first thing that they think about cutting back is music, which they consider to be a sort of something that they can comfortably do without, Bush's idea of stressing the three R's and as much as people would have you know that music is responsible for keeping our kids in school, they're performing in countless different ways in cognitive tests and it's Even so, schools feel like it's an expendable thing, and I think it will be a difficult thing to contend with in the future.
Did you guys get much music education, or was it how did you fall into you know being a musician, Mike?
Yeah, I was lucky. I mean, I had some I you know, took some piano lessons as a kid, and there were music classes at my school, and it's really a shame to think about kids not having those opportunities to learn music and connect with an instrument. And I agree. I think it's really great for mental development and just growing up. And it's a great thing. And it's a shame.
Okay.
Yeah. I was what we call a band geek through, you know, junior high and high school, and actually studied music in college with Greg here. And, it's the same thing, you know, some parents, first thing they think of, how do I get my kid through, you know, sports, keep him active, keep him focused on something. Music's very much the same thing, except that it's artistic value to it. So very glad that my, you know, was raised early on through piano lessons and whatnot.
Well, where did your inspiration come with, before we're going to have you play now? So what, tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write the music that you write. And,
I don't know. I picked it up in college pretty late, and then I just became very, very intrigued on writing music. You know, I always sang when I was younger and, you know, family little parties and whatnot, but I don't know. It's just something that grew on me as I got older and older.
And do you find, like, how much of the music comes from you guys and how much comes from, whoa, you know, we would probably get more gigs if we played a little bit this way or
kind
of tweaked?
Yeah, I mean, music's syncretic, so you learn from everybody. And I think, you know, nobody can come out here and say this is their own stuff. You're really inspired by other artists, whether it be down to the way they arrange music, to their lyrics, to their vocals. I mean, you can't sit here and say, yeah, I'm a lot like these two guys. It's, you know, hundreds of people all in one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't know if you agree.
Yeah. Mike, the same thing for you?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay. Well, let me, so with Swedish, why don't you describe your music?
It's what I call eclectic pop. So
eclectic pop. Okay.
We can't really put our finger on something. It's just whatever we enjoy writing.
All right. Let's hear some eclectic pop.
That's how you don't get a
record. What song are you going to play for us?
It's called,
what are the influences on this song?
This song is called Face Down from our latest album called
Awesome.
Life is Someone Else.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Live in the studio. Again, that was a local band Swedish, Jerry Melander and Greg Becerra on lead guitar. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing Bay Area's music scene from the trenches. And my guests are Jerry Melander, who's the founding member of the local band Swedish, along with Greg Becerra, who's the lead guitarist, David Schoenbrunn, the president of the Local 6 Musicians Union, and Mike Sempert, the founding member of the touring San Francisco band Birds and Batteries. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. I want to talk a little bit about different genres of music. I mean, you guys, you said that it was a little hard to define. So what are the genres of music these days in the scene in the Bay Area? Mike, maybe you can talk to that.
Man, that's a tough one. I don't really feel like there is like a Bay Area sound. I mean, I think if you hear a band from Brooklyn and you find out they're from Brooklyn, you're like, oh yeah, that's totally a Brooklyn.
Then why would it? Why?
Brooklyn band. But then, you know, that band could also be from Minneapolis. You don't know, you know, It's like, it doesn't, or you know, L.A. or whatever. I don't think that there are really any more like those types of really specific sound to city.
Is it because people move around so much?
No, I think it's because music has changed, and I think it has to do with just where we're at on the sort of continuum of music. That people aren't like shattering the mold. They're just kind of hybridizing and pulling from mostly 20th century influences that they love and that they grew up with.
Is that what you guys did with Birds and Battery?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's a fair amount of hybridization. I think Jerry's right that I can't say like that this is something I'm just making up out of thin air. This is, you know, taking all the things that moved me and music that I've loved, and sort of it's all being filtered through me into my music.
Okay. David, would you feel that, I mean, in terms of the different genres, I mean, do you see more of that as you have a variety of musicians that you represent?
Well, our musicians represent the spectrum of musical genres. It tends to be limiting itself a little bit more these days because of the rulings in the 70s, more towards classical musicians and people who play orchestral instruments, I would say. Although I think it could be the tide is turning, because we're really looking to represent more people and trying to find ways to living wages pay to more musicians.
Do you think
that's
that,
awesome? I'm excited about that.
Yeah, that was Mike. Do you think that classical musicians have a better chance at making a living because there are lots of opportunities for them?
They have less of a chance of getting hit record, probably, but
more opportunities as educators, probably. I mean,
I think there's when Michael said that he probably knows of four people who make a living playing music, and they're all in Oakland now. I probably know a couple of hundred people, at the very least, maybe more than that, who make a living playing music in San Francisco. But they do so playing in orchestras and playing in the theaters. And
do theaters have? I guess I'd heard somewhere that the theaters are using pre-recorded, not using the orchestra as much. Is that true?
Well, I think that's been a trend, but it's been a trend that we're trying to buck, actually.
Okay.
There's a machine called a virtual orchestra machine, which can actually be programmed to play a show alongside with a stage performance. And
wow.
And not only that, they're starting to use it for opera now as well. So I think it's
not including the singing, though, right?
No. Not yet.
Okay.
Well, including background vocals, unfortunately.
Wow. Let me take a couple more callers. We have Martine from San Francisco. Hi, Martine. Welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Well, we were listening to the show. It occurred to us to ask if any of the of your guests had given any thought to what it does to the local music scene when you take a alternative music venue on the air and you knock it out, like in this particular case, a third of a century of alternative music development at KUSF suddenly snuffed because somebody got ambitious for a fee.
Right.
Good point.
Mike, do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't have much to offer. I think you're right.
That over a long period of time, like crabgrass, people have a bunch of connections and a sense of goodwill in the community, which is pretty hard to replace just by shuffling the cards. So we thought possibly the effect would be to dry up some of the prospects for musicians, and therefore...
Yeah, I think there's less support when something like that dies, for sure.
Therefore we wanted to put in a plug for our friends at that particular frequency, and thank you.
Oh, sure. Thanks for calling in. Have either of you guys, or I guess, you know, you're a musician too, have any of you had songs that have made it to the radio? Like, I know KFOG promotes local musicians.
Mostly college radio.
Same with us, just college.
College radio. What does it take to go from college radio to the...
Payola.
Is it a pay thing?
Well, I mean, that's when you start, when you get on Clear Channel and that whole, you know, avenue, then you're talking to music directors, then you're talking to relationships and labels. I mean, that's where the labels kind of come in. And I don't know if you know a friend or somebody who works there, but that's just kind of what I've heard from...
So this Jeremy Melander from
Swedish.
Well,
I can't say that word. Never mind. We're on the air. So what you can do nowadays, I guess, is hire, you know, a PR agency to pitch your record. And it's a bunch of money. And I think that there are a lot of industries out there that are sort of taking advantage of artists and making money off of musicians who have sort of these hopes and dreams. There's plenty of other, you know, groups that really do work hard for their bands. But there's a lot of people out there that are figuring out that the audience is no longer sort of the target consumer. Now the bands are the target consumer.
And why is that?
Well, I think because more and more people are in bands, and I think because it's easier and easier to be in a band, and if we just pay this much money, then we'll get, you know, a campaign out of it or whatever.
I love that point. It's another thing about, like, those battle of the bands you see around. I don't know if not really in your territory, but there's a lot of these. It's the same type of thing where the target demographic is local bands, where they say, you know, we're doing a local venue, come out here and play. Then you find out they're charging, you know, $20 a ticket to get, you know, your friends in there on a Tuesday night in some, like, place in the peninsula.
Well, so is it now just, I'm really curious though. I mean, like, what does it take? Is it a label that will get you? What is the clincher for you guys in terms of thinking now you have peace of mind in terms of going from
I don't think there are any clinchers anymore.
There are no clinchers.
There are no clinchers anymore, at least for original music. I think, like, you know, for what David's dealing with, for people who have a skill that is needed in the context of, you know, playing this symphony or whatever, that makes a lot of sense. But for people who are trying to put something new out there, there's less demand for that because there's so much
and
I don't think there is a clincher. And I have close friends that signed to, like, what I would think would be my dream label, and they're doing the same stuff we are. They're not that much better off.
Well, let me ask you guys a question. Do you think people who come to clubs are aware of what you guys make? Do you think that they are aware that, you know, sometimes club owners hire you for the privilege of being able to sell your CDs or your or T-shirts or whatever from the bandstand?
The clubs I play, all they care about is how much people are going to buy at the bar.
That's really, that brings up a different, you know, let me go, we have a couple more callers, and then I want to go back to this bar because we have Kimo's who just closed, which is a really interesting issue. So let me go to Ricky. Hi, Ricky. Welcome to City Visions.
Hi, how are you doing?
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I want to respond to the comment earlier.
Hey, Ricky, can you turn your radio off?
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. I want to respond to the comment earlier about the music scene being alive and well. To a certain degree, I think there certainly are still musicians in the area. But, I mean, as far as it being alive and well, I think that several problems kind of have occurred inside of the scene. It's kind of coming from a lot of different places.
Okay.
And for one thing, even the audience, to a certain extent, has become a problem. You're running into such things where it's not so much that it's a problem, so much as you've got things like the guest list, you know, where so many bands will load their friends on the guest list, which, I mean, to a certain extent, is only kind of something that has come about in probably recent, just because, I mean, everybody's broke. So
I'm curious, are you a musician, or where are you coming from?
I'm a musician. I've been a promoter. I've done things from both sides.
Okay. And do you feel like this is a new thing?
To be quite honest, I'm not sure if it is a new thing. I think if anything, it may be a new thing just because the thought process is that you need to charge the audience to make money, which for my own part, I don't think is necessarily always the answer. I think that you could actually make more by not charging them and actually getting sponsors and stuff on events. But
okay. Do you have any questions for our guests, or?
I was more so responding to a comment earlier of the scene being alive and well.
Yeah, no, thank you. Mike, do you want to respond to that?
I mean, I guess that when I say the scene is alive and well, I don't mean everybody's making a lot of money or everybody's getting famous. I mean that good music is being made and real friendships are being built and maintained. And, you know, one of the things that's really encouraged me recently is that I've seen a certain amount of longevity amongst my peers, and bands that, you know, I was playing shows with 6 years ago are still playing shows and they sound better than ever. And yeah, is it frustrating that there aren't more people there to see them play, or that they have to work a zillion jobs to make it happen? Yeah, that's really frustrating. But it's encouraging to see them making great music. And that's kind of, I guess, what I'm trying to bring to the table here is some degree of just like, you know what?
There's lots of ways to look at this.
There's great music being made. And,
yeah.
And it's worth more than it's being paid for. But that's... we'll figure that out. I mean, we got a union here. We're going to start a union.
Is it enough just to be making great music? Is that enough?
Yeah. Well, I mean, is it enough to make a living on?
Well, is it enough for you?
Is it enough? Yeah, is it enough for
me,
you?
It's enough for
you. You've got your day job.
I do it for that, the passion of writing music. I just insist. I want to write creative music that pushes the edge. It makes me feel great about it.
But the problem is...
Sometimes it's enough.
You're convincing your audience and this listening audience that's why you play.
That's a really good point, David.
That in fact, maybe you don't deserve to... Or what you receive in psychic reward is in and of itself enough. And you don't deserve, or you don't feel like you deserve anymore.
Well, so there's two different lines, and I think this is good to talk about.
Yeah.
This is the progress of me being in this band, is in a nutshell, you get out of there trying to express who you are and what you believe. You have fun with it. Then you realize, okay, you know, to get the word out, I need to play a venue. And then you realize they're only going to let you play weeknights unless you drive in this much, yada, yada, yada. Next thing you know, you're writing lists of all of your friends based on where they live and sending out targeted email drops so they could drive to the right show at the right time, so you can get the right exposure and come back and play the next Saturday. It turns into a business,
right?
Ultimately. And so it gets away from this passion, and kind of like me scoring music with those software companies.
Right.
I got paid a lot of money, but it just was not worth to be have my creativity controlled. And that's where I just draw the line and not want to put in all this effort, all these resources to go down and play a Friday to where I'll drag, you know, 100 friends out and who probably won't come back the next week.
We have one more caller, and I want to make sure we get to him before we get to the top of the hour. We have Bob from Palo Alto. Good evening, Bob.
Hi, Lauren. My question is to the gentleman who just talked about writing, composing great music.
Jeremy Melinder.
And it relates to just the educational process for musicians, non-classical musicians. How much musical theory is needed to be able to, quote, write great music, unquote, And maybe you could begin by talking about what the definition of musical theory is.
Great question, Bob.
Love that question. I have a degree in music. And I studied at a music school out in the East Coast. So, you know, music theory is basically the fundamental understanding of Western music. So you've got, you know, the 12 note scale, chord progressions. I'm sure you can speak a lot more to this. But there's a lot of levels of understanding. So it boils down to, in a nutshell, this is my view on it, that there's kind of a mathematical equation on where you can go in chord changes. So it's tonally correct. There's certain things you can't do because it'll sound awkward. So it's really kind of adhering to this thing that's developed from classical music. I don't know if you want to add to that at all, what theory is. But I studied theory, and what that helped me out a lot in with Greg writing music is understanding, okay, what's going on with this last, you know, these two chords are playing on top of each other. So with that, it's a tool for me to understand how to get to the sound I'm trying to get to, but by all means, it is not required. Like I said, music is across the board. You know, people are doing a lot of atonal stuff. They're doing, you know, transient punk. I don't know if you want to add to it at all, but music's, you know, it's up to any person's taste. And by all means, you don't need, you know, that type of background.
Well, that's so. And what about you? Same thing for you, Mike? Or did you have kind of a similar?
Yeah, my first impulse is like, how much do you need? You don't need any, and a lot of great music gets made without it at all. I also have a music school background, and I have like a sort of left right side of the brain relationship with, you know, that part of my mind. I sort of turn off, I think, at critical moments, and I think we all do when it's time to just explore without a navigator. But then you get a little lost and you turn that part of your brain back on. It can be really handy to be like, why doesn't this sound good? Oh, I know why. Or you know, you can sort of navigate. So, but no, I don't think it's necessary.
And do you find that, Michael, do you find that you have like had to pay too much attention to the business for your liking, or has it been kind of okay?
I mean, I think if I had a choice, I wouldn't be putting nearly as many hours into that side of Birds and Batteries as I do. But I've come to accept it. And I think at a certain point, you know, no one's going to advocate for you as well as you can. And I don't know, there's that dream of passing off responsibilities. And I've done it where I've been, you know, pretty disappointed by what somebody has done on my behalf. And so, yeah.
Now you have control.
I double that. I just well said.
Well, we're coming to the top of the hour, so I want to first thank my guests for being here tonight and you know, giving us some insight into what goes on before, during, and after the show. And again, my guests are Jerry Melander, who's the founding member of the local band Swedish, along with Greg Becerra. David Schoenbrunn, who's the president of the Local 6 Music Union, and Mike Sempert, who's the founder of the touring San Francisco band Birds and Batteries. I want to play a little bit of Birds and Batteries. Maybe, what song are we listening to?
Oh, the song's called Rain Check, and it's on our last record, which is called Panorama.
Nice. So thank you all for listening.
Thanks,
our engineer this evening was Bob Summer. Tonight's producer was Matt Fidler. Great show, Matt. City Vision's founder was Rose Levinson, and Judith Stanson is our senior producer. And our other contributing producers are Susie Britton, Lisa Denemark, Victoria Thorpe. Join us next week when we'll be looking at what it's like to be gay and Catholic in the Bay Area. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the song. 'Cause I'll never know.